Okay, thank you. So I'd also like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity to speak here. So I'd like to tell you about some work that I've been doing with Andrew Essen, parts of which are still in progress, other parts of which are more or less done, on symmetry classification of Z2 spin liquids. So I'll tell you what that is. So I should probably start, since various people are classifying various kinds of things these days. There haven't been any talks yet in this program on classification. So maybe I should give you a little bit of motivation. Why classify? Okay. Why not? More seriously, certainly one of the things that we are trying to do as condensed matter theorists is understand different phases of matter, when two phases of matter are the same, when they're different. And part of any complete understanding of that is going to have to be a classification. So why try to classify spin liquids in particular? Well, there are longer term and shorter term reasons to try to do this. So a long term goal is maybe, it's quite ambitious probably, to try to develop some kind of general framework to understand states of quantum matter that fall outside of Landau symmetry breaking theory. So that's very ambitious, probably very long-term goal. Shorter-term, more practical goal is to any sort of classification, even if it's only a partial classification that we come up with, can probably help us to come up with sharp distinctions and maybe practical ways of determining sharp distinctions between distinct spin liquid phases. Okay. Just very crudely, we heard some of this in talks last week, of course. We certainly have pretty crude understanding of different types of spin liquids. So there are gapless states of various kinds, three-dimensional Coulomb phases. There are Z2 spin liquids with, say, gapless fermion excitations. There are also other spin liquids, spin on Fermi surface, algebraic spin liquids, where maybe there's not even a quasiparticle description at low energy. These kind of states, it's probably at this point completely hopeless to even think about classifying, because just understanding the theory itself, even for a few members of these groups of states, there are many issues that we don't understand. So in this talk, I'm going to be focused on a simpler group of states, so gapped topologically ordered states, and in particular, I'm going to focus on really the simplest gapped topologically ordered spin liquids, Z2 spin liquids. And of course, there's a lot of motivation to think about Z2 spin liquids in particular, given recent numerics that we've heard some about on square lattice J1, J2 model and Kagame lattice model, where there's evidence that these states actually exist in a rather simple, certainly not just a toy model. Okay. You could also add symmetry-protected topological phases, but depending on your taste and what you consider a spin liquid, maybe one does not consider these phases spin liquids. It's a matter of definition, but I wanted to include it in my list anyway. So what's the problem I'm actually interested in this talk? Okay, so here are some ingredients. So I want to consider some local bosonic model that is just a spin model. Okay. And I'll fix the topological order, and I'm going to fix it to something particularly simple, so just the same topological order of Z2 gauge theory, which I'll review in a bit. And then I suppose that there are some symmetries, so space group symmetry, time reversal, spin rotation, some subgroup of those. And subject to those criteria, what I'd like to do is try to classify distinct phases. Okay. I won't be able to completely do that. What I'll tell you about is something a bit less, which I'll call a symmetry classification. It's not a full classification of distinct such phases. Okay. So what do I mean by symmetry classification? Well, what I'll do is classify the distinct ways in which symmetries can act on the topological degrees of freedom, so in the end, there will be some symmetry classes, and the idea is that if you have two states in different symmetry classes, they have to be different. You could have two states in the same symmetry class, which are also different for some other reason, which is not part of this classification. Okay, so it's presumably not a full classification. Okay, so what what do these symmetry classes mean physically, so that they actually, they're not just something abstract, but that you'll see that these symmetry classes have a pretty simple physical meaning, and they really just correspond to different types of quantum number fractionalization that are possible in Z2 spin liquids. Okay, and I think this is a nice language for understanding what the distinct types of quantum number fractionalization are. Okay. So Young-Beck's pointer is, this has a laser pointer in it? No, it doesn't.
Yeah, that's why you use
that's why I'm having trouble. Yeah. That's right, you were using this in your talk. Okay, so, okay, so before I get started, so probably many of you are familiar with a piece of prior work which has a lot of the same issues in mind, and that's really this projective symmetry group classification of spin liquid states. And so what I'll say will have certain important things in common with that. So it's important to quickly remind you what that is, how it works, and what are some of its advantages and disadvantages. Okay. So I don't think it's really a symmetry classification, but it's in that direction. Okay. So let's consider a spin a half spin model, and we'll represent it with some fermionic partons. So we'll split the spin into fermions, just like in Young-Beck's talk. And then what you can do, you can write down a mean field Hamiltonian for those fermions. So it has in general some hopping and pairing terms. Then you suppose that your original model has some symmetries, say space group symmetry, time reversal, spin rotation, and there are a couple of observations. So one is that symmetries may act in a non-trivial way on this mean field Hamiltonian. So the underlying model, suppose it has translation symmetry, this Hamiltonian may look like it's not translation invariant, but it actually may be translation invariant when you supplement translation with some kind of a gauge transformation acting on the fermions. And that's perfectly fine because the physical spin operators are not affected at all by this gauge transformation, and they transform in the usual way under this translation operator. Okay. Because of the presence of these non-trivial gauge transformations, symmetries, we can say act projectively, acting on these fermionic partons, which could mean, for example, that Tx and Ty translations in the two lattice directions may not commute, but they may commute up to a phase instead. So this should remind you of magnetic translation group. And this is really just a, you can think of it as a generalization of magnetic translation group, where in this particular case, one's allowed to make not just U1 gauge transformations, but also SU2 gauge transformations. Okay, so how does one proceed starting from these two observations? So you can classify distinct ways that symmetries can act on these partons up to some kind of, really just up to unitary equivalence, or equivalence under some gauge transformations, SU2 gauge transformations. And you get some classes, and each such class is what's referred to as a projective symmetry group. Okay. They're just distinct ways that symmetries can act on the partons. I'm not sure this is really the best terminology, so I think it can lead to some real confusion, actually. So really, a projective symmetry group you shouldn't think of as a group. It's really, each PSG is a particular projective representation of the symmetry group. And so PSGs are some particular class of projective representations with some particular structure. Okay. All right. So what does this do? So it does give you a classification of mean field theories in the sense that if you have a mean field Hamiltonian with a given projective symmetry group, and then you ask what terms can you add to this Hamiltonian at the mean field level without breaking symmetry. That whole structure is dictated by PSG, and you can't change the PSG upon adding such terms at the mean field level. So really one would like to go beyond mean field theory. We don't just want a classification of mean field theories. And so starting from a mean field Hamiltonian like this, there are two ways to do that. You can couple the partons to a fluctuating gauge field, and depending on what mean field state you start with, the nature of that fluctuating gauge field can be different. In this talk, I'm thinking about Z2 spin liquid, so we could always imagine it's a Z2 gauge field. So that's one thing you can do. That gives you a low energy effective theory, okay, which you can then study. Or you can start with the mean field fermion wave function, and you can project it so that you get one fermion per site, and that gives you a wave function for the spin model. Okay. Okay, so this is what one does. So there are some pros and cons of this kind of approach. So first of all, you know, this is definitely a classification of Parton mean field theories. And so if you want to use Parton mean field theory for anything, it's a useful organizing principle. Okay, and you can think of it as organizing a construction of low energy effective theories and wave functions. Okay. Beyond that, it works for various types of spin liquids. Any spin liquid that you can construct a theory for or a wave function for in this Parton construction, this kind of approach works. Okay. But there are some disadvantages. So maybe the most obvious one is that this kind of approach is intimately tied to having some kind of Parton formalism. Okay, and in principle, there's no reason that our understanding of spin liquid states ought to be tied to partons. It's just a particular formalism which is sometimes useful, but certainly not necessary. Okay, and beyond that, there's not really a good argument that this should hold as a classification beyond mean field theory. Okay. Right. You can think of it as a classification of objects that are not just mean field theory. You can think of it as some kind of a classification of, say, Z2 gauge theories. But then you still have a problem that you could have two different Z2 gauge theories potentially describing the same phase. There could be some possibly complicated way to adiabatically connect them without breaking symmetry. And it's pretty hard to rule that out in the absence of some kind of argument. Okay, so I'm going to tell you about a different kind of symmetry classification, and you should really think of it as complementary to PSG. So the advantage is that you can really make an argument that it is a symmetry classification. It's not tied to some particular formalism or mean field theory. But there's a disadvantage, which is that I think it's probably limited to gap phases. I could give some arguments why it probably shouldn't work for gapless phases. And it's not constructive. It doesn't give you wave functions or low energy effective theories. Okay. So if you have an effective theory, you can work out what symmetry class one's in, but there's no prescription for going the other way. Okay. So there's another piece of prior work that I should also mention, which is actually described as some ideas along very similar lines to what I'm telling you, described in Alexei Pitayev's 2006 Annals of Physics paper in Appendix F, if anybody made it that far. That's the last appendix.
Which paper from 2006 is it?
I think there's only one Annals of Physics paper by him in 2006. It's the one on the honeycomb lattice model. Yeah, but it has many other things in it. Yeah. And so to the extent that I understand what's contained in Appendix F, which is, I don't want to give you a numerical estimate of what fraction of Appendix F that is, but to the extent that I understand what's contained there and well, where, to the extent that the results overlap, we agree. All right. So okay. So here's the outline for the rest of the talk. So first, I need to give you a review in a particular language that's going to be useful for my purposes of just what are the topological properties of Z2 spin liquid. So I need to remind you what kind of topological order we're dealing with, and then the rest of the talk I'll try to explain how this symmetry classification works. Okay. So I'll explain. I want to explain the topological properties in the maybe somewhat abstract language of topological particle types and superselection sectors. So, but you can always have, well, and I'll remind you of a concrete model, toric code model, in a minute. So that's coming. If anyone wants to be reminded. You can also just have a Z2 gauge theory in the back of your mind. So there are three non-trivial types of topological particles, okay, and I'll we can talk a little bit more in a second about what that means. There are two bosons, which I'll call E and M, and there's one fermion, which I'll call epsilon. And so in a Z2 gauge theory, M is usually associated with the bison. It's just a flux of the Z2 gauge field. And if we have a Z2 gauge theory coupled to bosonic matter fields, E is the Z2 electric charge, and then epsilon is a charge flux bound state, which we know is a fermion in that case. Okay. Or if you have a Z2 gauge theory with fermionic matter, topological order is the same, but there epsilon is the electric charge and E would be the charge flux bound state. Okay. All right. So these are just some particle types. There are also fusion rules. So if you fuse anything with itself, you get the trivial particle, or one, which is not part of the topological structure. It doesn't have any statistics with itself or anything else. And if you fuse any two different particles, you get the other one, which is kind of already expressed here by saying that some of these are bound states of the other two. Okay, and I already said what the self statistics of all these particles is, but they also have mutual statistics, so any distinct pair, if you take one all the way around the other, has pi mutual statistics. Okay, so a couple things to mention about this. First thing is there's no real distinction between E and M. It's clear that they're just names. This structure is invariant under a relabeling of E goes to M. Okay, so that's important to keep in mind. Usually we associate M with a bison and E with a charge, but that really has more to do with some particular Hamiltonian description and not with the topological order itself. So we can relabel E and M, and none of this structure changes. Okay. Another thing that's worth mentioning is that there's an old issue which people have talked about it various times, which I will not really be able to resolve, not completely resolve anyway, which is, you can write down a theory for a Z2 spin liquid which starts with bosonic spin-ons, or another one that starts with fermionic spin-ons. And there's a question, is there any fundamental difference between these two kinds of things? This way of thinking about it suggests that there should not be any fundamental difference. Okay, and that's also my personal opinion, but to really establish that requires a little bit more than I'll be able to say. Okay, but that's an issue that you might want to keep in the back of your mind.
But you're also restricting yourself to 2D.
I'm restricting myself to 2D, yeah. I meant to say that at some point, but forgot. Thanks. Okay, so beyond just talking about particle types, it's helpful to also think about topological superselection sectors. So there's just one associated with each particle type, including the trivial particle. So the trivial superselection sector contains actually, if you have a spin model in a closed system, that contains all the physical spin wave functions. Okay, what do the other sectors mean? Well, roughly speaking, you can think of a state in the E superselection sector as a state with a single isolated E boson. Now, you should worry a little bit about what that means, because you can't put a single E boson in a closed system, right? And that's one of the reasons that these particles are non-trivial, right? You can't create a single isolated E particle. You have to create them in pairs and then separate them. Okay. So the physical meaning of these states, of these superselection sectors, I think is really the following thing.
Is it a system with no edges right now?
Or? No. I want to imagine a system, I want to imagine a closed system with no boundaries.
On a torus or something.
Yeah, on a torus.
Torus or sphere, does it matter?
I want to say torus because I'd like to keep the space group symmetry, and I know how to do that on a torus. And on a sphere, you can't always do that. Yeah. So let's focus on tori. Yeah. What I think, so a good way to think about what these sectors mean is the following thing. So there's a ground state, and then, there are actually four ground states, but above a single ground state, there are some, these topological particles are gapped excitations. Because they're gapped, you can localize them. And what it means to have a state in the E sector is really that you have a region of the system within which there's, say, one E boson, And at least for some length outside this region, the system is locally in the ground state. Okay, and you can certainly do that because the system is gapped. So you should think about a sort of excitations that are reasonably dilute. Okay, you don't have too many of these quasi-particles around. Okay, so really, you know, if there's an E boson here, we're sort of focusing on this region, but there have to be another one somewhere else to have a legitimate wave function for the whole system. Okay. And so that will actually be important later on. Within this region where we have one E boson, we can act with all kinds of local operators. Okay, you can act with lots of spin operators. You can dress this E boson in complicated ways, but you won't change the superselection sector that you're in, basically because local operators, all they can do is they can just create pairs of the various excitations. So within this sector, if you create a pair of M particles, well, that doesn't really do anything because the important thing is the number of M particles mod 2. Okay. So that's the next important point, that these superselection sectors, they're really closed under the action of local operators. Okay, if you start with a state in this sector and you act on it with some local operators, you just get another state in the same sector. Okay, so that's the idea. And in particular, there can be no matrix element of any local term in the Hamiltonian that takes you between two different sectors. All right. Okay, so to get a little more concrete, which will also be useful, so let me remind you of this toric code model.
I'm sorry. Last slide.
Yeah.
So this was the last thing about sectors that close under that assumption.
I think it's part of the definition, actually.
So the first sector contains all physical states, including the shells.
But I was thinking.
Well, that one is obviously closed.
Yeah, I was thinking. Sometimes under translation, as we discussed, E can go to M under translations.
Ah, okay. But that's not a local operator. That's a global operation. Okay. So let me just remind you of this toric code Hamiltonian. So we're on the square lattice. We put Ising variables on the links. We act on them with Pauli matrices, sigma z and sigma x. So there are two terms in the Hamiltonian. There's a Plaquette term, product of sigma z around a Plaquette, vertex term, product of sigma x on this blue cross. The Hamiltonian only involves these vertex and Plaquette operators, and they commute, and there are two coefficients here. And because of that commutation, this Hamiltonian is exactly solvable. You can enumerate all the states in the spectrum. What you can also do is you can vary the sign of these two terms, U and K, that will be useful for us because these different possibilities for the sign will belong to different topological classes. And actually, that's something that's probably familiar to a lot of people. If U is positive, then these vertex operators are 1 everywhere in the ground state. But if U is negative, then the vertex operators are always minus 1. And this is just, you can think of this as a Z2 gauge theory with a background of electric charges. It's just odd Z2 gauge theory. Okay. And if you change the sign of this, what you're doing is putting flux in every Plaquette. You're putting a minus 1 flux in every Plaquette. Okay. So, it's important to keep in mind the signs of these two terms, SV and SP. So there's a fourfold ground state degeneracy on the torus. You can think of that as threading some visons through the loops, the two holes in the torus. There are four ways to do that. More formally, you can also define some loop operators, which are just products of sigma x and sigma z going across your torus in different ways. This electric loop operator, I called it an electric loop operator because this loop operator you can think of as an operator that that takes one of the E particles and moves it all the way around the system, and vice versa for the for these M loops or magnetic loops. Okay, so these pairs of these loop operators anti-commute, and so from this algebra follows the fourfold ground state degeneracy. Okay, all right. So that's so if anything was unclear there, this would be a good time to ask some questions before I move on.
No,
important is the locality for this crust flow?
Well, I don't even know in what sense topological order is well defined if you sacrifice locality and be delicate. So I just want to assume it.
One question. So there are two kinds of geography. One is like twisted geography, where there are three fermions of the one boson, and other geography where there are three bosons and one fermion. There's this twisted versions. So the mutual statistics is essentially same, but the set statistics is different. So
You're talking about this case where all three of the non-trivial particles are fermions.
And the last one is boson. So
what do you mean? Well, the trivial one is always a boson.
So does that come out of the analysis itself? Like when you finally find the cell statistics in this analysis?
Okay. So I'm fixing the topological order. So I'm assuming that I have, you know, I have the trivial particle, I have two bosons, I have one fermion. That's all fixed by assumption. So I will never consider that case. But we could try to think about that case too. But I'm not considering it.
I'm thinking if you keep the fusion rules same, that you come out.
I think that the answer is likely to be very similar in that case. But there are certain things I don't know how to do in that case that I do know how to do in this case. We could talk about it afterwards. So here's the basic idea. So let's consider something simple to start. So suppose we've just got translation symmetry. So two generators, Tx and Ty, and they commute, which you can express this way. But we're doing quantum mechanics, and so we can say, well, maybe they just commute up to a phase. But on any physical spin wave function, basically just because the say Tx acts on the spin operators in this fashion, this phase is just one. Okay, so Tx and Ty commute on any physical spin wave function. Okay. However, on the other super selection sectors, there's no reason that this phase has to be one. Okay. And really that comes in because you can't have in a closed system, you really have to have pairs of these excitations. Okay. So the next thing we can say is, suppose that on some, say on the E superselection sector, on some particular state, I'll worry about how these translation operators are defined on that sector in a minute. Suppose that you compute this somehow and you get some phase. Okay, and you get some phase on one particular state. So the next thing you can say is that this phase has to be constant on that sector. Okay, it can't change from state to state, because if it did change from state to state, you could find some local operator, just some product of spin operators or something, that takes you from one state to the other state. Okay, but in order for that to be true, that local operator would have to be acted on non-trivially by this product, which is impossible. Okay, so that would be a contradiction. So this thing has to be a constant on super selection sectors. Okay. The other thing that we'll see in a second is that not only is this constant, but it has to take discrete values. And that will come from the fusion rules. And therefore, it can't change as long as the sectors stay well-defined and the gap stays open. And so this is an argument that specifying these phases is really a universal property of a given Z2 spin liquid. Okay. So you can use this to robustly characterize different Z2 spin liquid states. Okay, so hinting at something that Tarun asked about, in this talk I'm not going, it's possible, it happens in models, for some symmetries to interchange the E&M particles. I'm not going to discuss that in this talk. We're thinking about that, but I understand it not sufficiently well that I want to talk about it in public yet. But if you want to know my current thoughts, you can ask me after the talk. But just for simplicity, you can imagine I'm just going to ignore that case. Okay, so maybe the next thing to talk about is how we even define Tx and Ty within a sector, right? Because after all, the physical states live in the trivial sector, and the translation operator of the system is just that. It's the translation operator. You translate all of the spins in the system at the same time. So there's a question of what does it mean to talk about the translation operator in a sector. So if you think about an E particle or a state in the E sector, the way to define translation in the E sector is an operation that takes that quasiparticle and moves it over with respect to the imagine its translation invariant background of the ground state. Okay, and if you think about how PSG works, that's really what translation acting on one of the parcons does too. It's some kind of a single particle translation operator. So you should think of it as something that's moving a quasiparticle, but not, but it's moving it with respect to a background. Okay. So that's what I mean. So once you say this, then the rough idea is that suppose you have a state with two E particles, which can be a state of the real system. So then translation acting on that state, you should expect that it may have a product structure. So it should be a product of a piece that translates one particle and a piece that translates the other particle. Okay, and actually this can be constructed explicitly for the toric code. And I'll explain quickly how that works in a little bit. Okay, but for now, let's just assume that you can do something like this. Okay, so the idea is that the real translation operator is a product of some sector translation operators. And this product structure is important because if you compute this group relation for this sector translation operator, you could get some phase, but this product structure really is expressing the fusion rules, and it tells you that this phase can only be plus or minus one. Because if you compute the group relation with this, you have with this and Ty, you have to just get one. Okay, so this is a constraint that's imposed, in this case, by the E squared equals one fusion rule. And the other fusion rules impose similar constraints, so same thing for the M sector and the epsilon sector. And then the other fusion rule tells you that an epsilon is a bound state of an E and an M, and that also gives you a constraint that this parameter for the epsilon is a product of the other two. Okay. All right, naively you might say there are three Z2 parameters, but because of this, there are actually only two independent Z2 parameters. So there are four possibilities, but actually that only gives you three distinct classes because two of them are related by relabeling E to M, and there's no way to tell them apart. Okay, so that's more or less the answer for the case where you have only translation symmetry. There are these three classes. So in order to understand what those classes are, it's probably helpful to explain how you can actually do some of this explicitly for the toric code, which was actually quite quite useful for us to get certain things right. So the idea is basically that you have imagine you have a state with two E particles. You can just translate that state by moving everything over. So the E particles are connected by a string. You move everything, including the string. But instead of doing this, okay, we'd like to write this as a product of an operator that translates just this particle and something that translates just this one. Well, you can do that by adding a piece of string here to move this one over and adding a piece of string here to move that one over. Okay. That's not quite right because this piece of string has got to be shifted over so that you get to the same final state. Okay, but you can do that because you're allowed to move the strings against the background of the ground state. You may get some phase when you do that. So if your toric code has the ground state such that there's a flux in every plaquette, then you may get a minus sign upon doing this. But the important point is that this minus sign has a nice structure, so you can factor it and associate some piece of it with the operator that translates this particle and another piece with the operator translating this one. So from this, you get some expression, which not surprisingly is just a sigma z matrix that inserts a piece of string, okay, with some phase factor in front. So acting on this state, we've shown that you can write the translation operator as this product. Okay. All right, so let me go a little further. So once you have the form of this object, you can use it to compute the group relation. You see that all this thing does is it just corresponds to moving the E particle around a plaquette. So you act with this four times in this fashion, you get a product of sigma z's, it's the plaquette operator acting on the ground state that gives you plus or minus one, depending on the sign of the plaquette term in the toric code model. You can do the same thing in the magnetic sector, except it's the sign of the vertex next term that matters. And you can also show that no matter how many E and M particles you have, there's a similar product structure for the translation operator. And don't worry about the details of that formula. Okay. You can also show that these relations don't change even when you have both E and M particles present. That's not immediately obvious. There are some things you have to check. You have to check that, for example, linking of these kind of loops or enclosing, if a loop may enclose a quasiparticle of the other type, you have to check that that does not cause any problems. Okay. And there are minus signs that come from that, but they always wind up canceling, it turns out. Okay. So, okay. Maybe I'll skip this. Let me just say you can connect this to ground state quantum numbers. Okay, maybe I'll very quickly explain. The rough idea is very simple. The idea is that a loop operator in the x direction, an electric loop operator, you can get that just by thinking about translating one particle around your torus by the width of the system in one direction. And so you can make this association between the loop operator and the sector translation operator. And you can use that to work out how symmetry acts on the loop operators. In the toric code, you can just do it directly. Or you can use it, you can also use this formalism to do it. And it's kind of obvious that in the toric code, the answers are the same, because these are almost the same object, even formally. Might not be obvious in some other case. One thing to point out is that this actually only gives you, so you can use this to learn something about the momenta of the degenerate ground states, but it only tells you about relative momenta. It doesn't tell you if there's some absolute momentum that it doesn't tell you. And that's probably right in some sense. Maybe that information is not here in this symmetry classification, because, you know, what this has to do is the process, this kind of thing has to do with the process of going from one ground state to another one by creating two E particles, moving one around in a circle, and then annihilating them. So it's a process that takes you from one ground state to another. But at least thinking in this way, there's clearly not going to be information about the absolute quantum numbers of the ground states. But it's still useful. So maybe I'll finish with this, even though it's a little abstract. Let me mention first a couple of other things. So this construction for the toric code, you can generalize it to a case where you have more than just translation symmetry. You can. So we've done it for the full space group plus time reversal. It's technically a lot more complicated, actually, so I don't want to show it to you. But if anyone wants to hear about it, I can tell you later. And there are some technical issues that we're still sorting out, in fact, because it is quite complicated. So based partially on that, there's a prescription that I can give you for a general symmetry group, which is worth mentioning. And so I have to tell you about a little mathematics, but I'll try to keep it as light as possible since people are probably getting hungry for cookies. So let's suppose we have a symmetry group G with some elements, and let's consider a projective representation of that symmetry group. So that's what gamma is. It's just some matrices, just some projective representation. So we know when you've got a projective representation that gamma of G1, gamma of G2 might not exactly be gamma of G1, G2. There could be some phase factor sitting there, okay? And for our purposes, because of the constraints of fusion rules, we want this phase factor to just be plus or minus 1. Okay, so this phase factor, it's a function of two group elements. It's called a factor set. In this case, it's a Z2 valued function of two group elements. If you play with this, there's an associativity constraint on these factor sets, which is written here. You just multiply by another gamma, and then you can associate in two ways. That gives you a constraint. Any such function that satisfies this constraint is a legitimate factor set. Okay, and it turns out that these factor sets have an abelian group structure, which is just given by taking a product of two of them. Okay, and that actually has some physical meaning, because if you have two projective representations and take their tensor product, as you would if you're fusing particles, then the factor set of the resulting tensor product representation is just this product. Okay. So in addition to that, there's also some gauge redundancy here because you can change the phase of any of these group elements in the projective representation by minus one. Okay. And if you think back to this kind of product structure, where is it? Here. Those are exactly the transformations that leave the translation operator invariant. So you can only make Z2 phase transformations. You can't make, say, U1 phase transformations because they've changed the form of this operator. I think Ashwin wants me to finish soon, so let me try. The idea is you can classify these factor sets up to this gauge equivalence that defines some equivalence classes. Those also form an abelian group, which it turns out, for me, this is just a name because this is what I understand, and this is just a convenient way of expressing it. This is the second group cohomology group with coefficients in Z2. But if that means nothing to you, then forget I said it. They form an abelian group. So the point is that the symmetry class for one sector winds up being an element of this group, or one of these factor set classes. Okay. So that's the sort of natural generalization of what I told you for translations. So what does this mean? And maybe this is the last thing I'll say. So this factor set class is not tied to a particular group representation. And so for a given class, there's a list of representations that all have the same factor set in the same class. Okay. They're all projective in general, of course. And so really what these classes do is they characterize sort of different types of projective representations. It's a coarser classification than just looking at representations. Okay. And really what these classes correspond to is really different types of quantum number fractionalization. That's a good way to think about them. So really that's what these symmetry classes are. They're different, they're really distinct types of quantum number fractionalization. So spin rotation is a simple example. There are two classes according to whether you rotate by 2 pi, you get plus or minus 1, and that just tells you whether your particles have integer versus half-odd integer spin. Okay, so that's a simple, familiar example, but this works for discrete groups too. Those are some details that I don't need to talk about. So there are various open issues here. Probably the most important one is given some physical data, like somebody's wave function from exact diagonalization or from the DMRG calculation, how can you determine this class? Okay. Or maybe not just given the ground state, maybe given some excited states. That's probably easier. Not quite. Right, easier to think about, but not easier to do. I have some vague ideas about this, but I don't think I have a good, I certainly don't have a good practical suggestion yet. So this is one place which is open and which I think is important to think about more because it would be useful to make some suggestions given all the interesting numerics that are going on. Okay, thanks.
Okay, maybe just one. If you instead chose to work with the K matrix formulation in the Z2 case, does that lead to any? Can you make progress with the symmetry classification based on the K matrix?
I haven't tried to think about that yet, but I'd like to think about it. Yeah.
So just staying within the Z2 sort of context, the transitions between different classes, they're all in 2 and 3. Are they phase transitions or disorder points?
Transitions between different.
So if you had a Hamiltonian that have both phases as ground states for some different sort of parameter values.
Are these ground state classifications or are they classifications of the properties of the excitations?
Right, so it's based on looking at the properties of the excitations, but I presume that the information is probably there in the ground state. So at least for these, Central is shaking his head, but at least in these three classes with translating, well, maybe, okay. Yeah, so in these three cases, At least two out of the three, they can be distinguished pretty easily by looking at the ground state.
Different phases.
So the ground states, they ought to be different.
Just phase transitions of binding and unbinding.
No, you can't do that. Yeah, so I think the ground states have to be different.
Okay. So you have to close the gap?
You have to close the gap, yeah. Now, what I don't know of is a model that actually has a direct continuous transition from, say, one of these classes to the other. You can do that in a toric code, but it's a very, very sick, fine-tuned point with too many low-energy excitations.
Okay.
What about Bayes' clock model? That there's two G2 phases. Can you describe that using this?
Yeah, so I think Wendt's Plaquette model is actually the same as the toric code, but with the coefficients of vertex and Plaquette terms equal.
There are two phases, G2A, G2B.
Yeah, so I haven't thought about that case in as much detail because there the elementary translation actually interchanges E and M. And so that's more complicated to think about for the following reason. So all of this is based on defining this translation operator in a sector, which really it's a local operator that moves some quasiparticle locally. Okay. If you have a symmetry that interchanges E and M, it's impossible to do that. You can't define that anymore. So you have to think about those kind of operations differently. And I have what I would say is a conjecture at this point for kind of what is the data that you need to specify. But I'd like to see it come out of looking at that model, but we haven't done that yet.
Your last question, please.
So in the last part of your talk, you mentioned that for an internal symmetry, you need to calculate this H up 2 with coefficient Z2, right? So is this all the solution from...
It's not just internal symmetry, it's space group too.
Oh, you mean even for space group?
Yeah.
So G can
yeah.
be either, but
yeah.
So far, if we only consider internal symmetry, so in this case, all the solutions will give rise to different solutions, or you need some additional consideration?
Like are all the solutions distinct? Like, are they all distinct? Are all these classes really distinct phases? Or can you realize, yeah.
Some are potentially in some phase of matter.
Right, so there are two, maybe you didn't ask both questions, but there are two questions.
Yeah.
There.
Sorry, my question is that I'm wondering, you still need some additional constraint because in this case, it's kind of like you consider the symmetry G extension of this toric code model, but there is some mathematical theory. I think you need to consider this some so-called obstruction conditions. So kind of you compute if you get any solutions from this H up to GZ2, then you can use the stimulus square to promote to H up 4, and then you need to require this H up 4 with coefficient U1 to be trivial. I think there are some...
Okay, we should talk afterwards, because maybe after I talk to you, I'll understand more of
the